Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, February 18th, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember, our shows are available 24/7 on prn.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that will include, do vegetarians really have a lower risk of heart disease?
And does vitamin C cause or prevent kidney stones?
Does everybody need a calcium supplement?
What's the difference between systolic and diastolic hypertension?
And is melatonin an effective cancer treatment? Might put you to sleep, huh?
Well, with heart disease, our number one killer, it's important that we figure out what's causing it. And a large British study shows that vegetarianism can reduce the risk of heart disease by a third. Now, this means that those who eat both meat and fish were 32% more likely to be hospitalized or die of a heart attack. Uh-oh. What were the differences in the vegetarian compared to the non-vegetarian in this study?
Yeah, this was a good study. It was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition in January of 2013, and it came out of the University of Oxford. And it was the largest study that was done looking at this particular aspect of vegetarians versus non-vegetarians in heart disease. They had 45,000 people who were in the study, 34% of which were vegetarian, meaning they had no meat or fish. The study was for 15 years, and then they looked at the risk of hospitalization or death, as Vicki said, from heart disease. They had 1,235 cases of heart disease, 169 deaths, and about 1,000-plus hospitalizations. And what they found is just what Vicki said. There were 32% fewer deaths in the group that was vegetarian. But the real question here is what does it mean when they're talking about non-vegetarians?
Well,
what
first
kind
of all,
meat were they eating?
Yeah. And first of all, though, I think we should mention that the vegetarians had a lower blood pressure. They had lower cholesterol.
Yeah.
They found that their weight was less and they had less risk of diabetes. So it was more than just having heart attacks.
But
or heart
here's
disease.
The real question, Vicki. When you eat meat, what does that mean? Are you going down to your local supermarket and buying feedlot beef? Are you talking about something where you're getting grass-fed beef? Are you talking about wild game? Because there are big differences in those, what we call meat.
Yeah, that would have been very important to have distinguished between that and the study, especially when they did it on so many people, because we all know that feedlot beef is not healthy, plus the fact that they feed them things that aren't good for us. And that the conditions that they're living in, and that they put hormones and antibiotics and all that,
and reading pesticides
and growth
too.
Hormones, yeah.
Right. And then they fatten them up for 6 months prior to the time that they go to slaughter, so that there'll be more fat in the meat.
Well,
that's
organic,
a whole lot different.
Organic grass-fed meat actually is very healthy. It's high in omega-3 fats, just like fish is, and it has less saturated fat, and then, of course, it doesn't have the hormones and the antibiotics or the pesticides. And also, it's less stressful for those poor cows
when
they're
right.
slaughtered, you know.
Well, it's different. That's right. And they also have something more called CLA, or conjugated linoleic acid. And most of us don't know what that is, but basically it's something when there's more of, it does some good things to meat, dairy, and eggs where it's found. It's great in Crohn's disease, which is inflammatory bowel disease.
Well, what is it? What does it do?
Well, it reduces the inflammation. It slows down the diarrhea. It heals the lesion some with just about 6 grams a day. It also helps lower body fat in people. It produces more lean muscle mass. It slightly decreases weight. So CLA is something that's twice as concentrated in meat that's grass-fed or in wild game.
Well, grass-fed beef also is low in cholesterol.
Uh-huh.
And it has more vitamins A, E, and antioxidants.
Mm-hmm.
I think another thing to bring out here is that vegetarians need more B12 and zinc because you do get that in meat.
Right. So we're looking here at something that's really important in terms of doing a clinical trial and then making suggestions about what to do or what not to do. based on that clinical trial. You've got to know what your baselines are in that. And when you do what this particular study did, you haven't got a clue, and it gives a bad name to people who are meat eaters that are eating really healthy meat.
Well, you know, labeling can be tricky, too, because there's really no regulation, and some of the grass-fed are finished on grains at a feedlot. Mm-hmm. However, they're still nutritionally superior to feedlot beef because they're just getting it at the end of their life rather than starting them out and having them on it the whole time. But what about the fish eaters?
Well, I mean, fish is something, the pescatarians, okay, that's what a fish eater is. They have fruits and vegetables, and they add fish to it. It's very good because now you're looking at adding essential fatty acids. And those essential fatty acids, those omega-3s and 6s that we have, they're absolutely essential for life. And our bodies cannot make those particular nutrients. And we know from the studies that were done by the USDA on tens of thousands of people on at least three occasions that about 95% of the population is deficient in those particular essential fatty acids. So it's really important that we include that in our diet someplace, and fish, of course, is loaded with it. And look at all the good things that those essential fatty acids do. It's why we try to give them to people who have heart disease or chronic diseases, because we can't heal without essential fatty acids. It waterproofs the skin. It helps to control cholesterol levels. It makes healthy cell membranes. It makes your brain work better, and a high percentage of what the brain is composed of is essential fatty acids. It works as an anticoagulant.
Antiarrhythmic.
Antiarrhythmic, so it helps control people and keeping them from getting cardiac rhythm disturbances that they might not otherwise get. In fact, it's the most powerful. Fish oil is the most powerful antiarrhythmic agent known to man, even compared to the antiarrhythmic drugs that we have that have so many side effects.
They should be giving this to people that are in the CCUs.
Oh, they definitely should be doing
telemetry units.
Sure, and what's the downside to it? Maybe somebody might get a little burping or indigestion from it if they take too much of it. But in general, the highly purified fish oils, or just eating fish, is a good way to go. Because
they should serve them fish in the hospital.
They should definitely do that. You know, when they did that in the schools and in prisons in New York City, where they just added fish a couple times a week, violence went down about 44%. People did better in school. They did better in their star testing. Fish is a wonderful thing to add to your diet.
The catch here is that there are a lot of reasons to be vegetarian, mm-hmm. and to choose not to eat meat or fish. And it could be religious or animal rights, political, environmental, cultural, economic, you know, of course, health related also. But if it's one of these other reasons, what do you suggest for people? Like probably to take some supplements, huh?
Well, I mean, we use essential fatty acids from seeds and nuts. So we get it from flaxseed oil, from hemp products, from chia seeds, and from numerous other kinds of sources. But the problem with that is that it's not that they don't have the building blocks for the essential fatty acids, the threes and sixes. They do. But they may not have the downchain metabolite capacity. They may not be able to convert what they eat into the downchain metabolites. So in the omega-3 side, we have alpha-linolenic acid, which is what is the base nutrient that's found in seeds and nuts. But we may not have the delta-5 and delta-6 desaturase enzymes that convert it into EPA and DHA, which are the most active ingredients that we need. And on the omega-6 side, the linoleic acid also needs delta-5 and delta-6 essential fatty delta-5 and delta-6 enzymes to be able to convert that linoleic acid into GLA, arachidonic acid, and a lot of other anti-inflammatory fatty acids that are very important for our health. So you're better off with the fish in general, particularly if you're in a risk group that can't convert what you eat from the seeds and nuts into the active ingredients.
I just had somebody tell me the other day that they were allergic to fish.
That could be. And so then they may not be able to do it that way. But so you do what you can. But you need all those breakdown products, or else you're not getting the benefits. I mean, look at the kids with ADD and ADHD. They can't convert what they eat in seeds and nuts, the alpha-linolenic acid and the linoleic acid, into the downchain metabolites. And that's what leads to the hyperactivity that they have and the lack of concentration and all the other problems that they have.
Well, what about some of the other things like the B12 and the zinc, for example?
Well, you may have to supplement with that. There's probably no other way to do it. And of course, today that's not a big problem because we have plenty of ways to get
supplements.
Yeah, you can get sublingual B12 and it does just a fine job.
And not sublingual, but zinc that you suck on.
Oh, yeah, sure. If you've got a cold, everybody's talking about that.
That's what about vitamin A, E, and some of the antioxidants?
Well, I think if you just eat plenty of fruits and vegetables, you don't have to worry about that. I mean, that's obviously very important, too. We don't get all of what we need from any one particular food group. But the problem is that we need to have a balanced diet, but it also depends on who we are. I mean, look at the Eskimos. They had a diet that's what?
High in lard.
Well, it's high in whale and in fat and in other fish. And they didn't have any vegetables and they didn't have any fruits. And they did just fine. But you take a person that's living on the equator or somebody that lives in Europe or America and put them in their environment and try to feed them all that, they might not do as well. There are a lot of things that we do to adjust to Mother Nature as we've lived there for tens of thousands of years that make us able to cope a certain way. You might not want to take an Eskimo and put him on the equator. I mean, lots of problems with that. So how and what we need and what we eat depends a lot on where we live and what our ethnic backgrounds are. Then we get to the problem of, at least for me, of being reverent and thankful and grateful for the food that we eat. I mean, look at the meats that we consume. Does the way that they're slaughtered make a difference? I think it does. The Native Americans had it right. When they went on a buffalo hunt, it was a sacred journey. And when they killed the buffalo, it was with remorse because they didn't want to take the life of the animal. But at the same time, they gave thanks and appreciated what was being given to them. And we're eating a product that was really quite healthy. You look at wild game, it's much different than feedlot beef. And it's not like we should be we should be eating just that in our diets. It should be balanced. We come from all kinds of ethnic groups in this country. We're like a hodgepodge of people.
Well, you know, on the internet, I'm always getting these emails that are so sweet, you know, of animals that like each other and how nice they are to each other, even if they're different species of animals and that kind of thing. And then I got one the other day that was talking about how a lot of these emails are photoshopped to look that way. Mm-hmm. Because when you really think about it, out in nature and out in the wild, these animals are you know, I mean, that's how they live. They kill each other and eat each other.
Well, we're an animal
some
too.
Some of them even eat their own. But I mean,
well, it's hard to make logical sense out of what happens in nature. It's sort of like the way it is.
And many of us block out what it is that we're really eating. I mean, if you really think about what you're eating, that's why a lot of people are vegetarians. They can't stand the idea of eating a cute little lamb.
I agree. Well, that's an important point. I think there's a sacred approach to that should be respected that we tend not to think about. Of course, a lot of the meat that we get is meat in fast food restaurants, and there you're looking at all kinds of stuff that's got additives and preservatives.
Processed meat.
Yeah, it adds this pink stuff everybody was talking about that's called pink slime.
Glue.
It's not really meat at all.
Meat glue.
And in you're looking at some of the Orient, some of the way meat is prepared in the Orient, and they're adding melamine to it, which is a protein that can't even be digested and serves no particular purpose and actually can cause disease in people.
And why do they add it?
It's cheaper. They save money when they add
protein.
It's like
a filler.
So it's a filler to meats. Yeah, exactly. And then look at the GMO side of this, too. I mean, what are we feeding our feedlot beef?
Yeah, corn.
Yeah, corn.
Corn-fed beef. Oh, boy, you're going to get something really special. Well, that makes it fatter, too.
Well, look what happens.
That's why they feed it to them.
Look what happens to rats that are fed GMO corn their whole life, or mice that are. They get these big cancerous breast tumors. And now we're even looking at GMO fish. I mean, the world is being, I mean, Mother Nature is being invaded in ways without much respect or concern. And when that happens, what do you think is going to happen to you? I mean, all these things you pay a price for because you don't know when you change one segment of the environment, what it's going to do to another. And maybe not now, maybe it'll be in 6 months or 6 years or 60 years. All these things make a big difference. So there's a lot more to a study that this was presented in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, talking about vegetarians have less heart disease than people who eat meat. But I'm sure what they're talking about is feedlot beef. And we have to worry about that because they're not comparing it fairly. What study has ever been done that has compared vegetarians to people who eat, say, wild game or to hunters that only consume that? I don't know of any studies. And I suspect that what's going to happen is when they do that study, that it's going to be a totally different outcome because it's a totally different product. So what you eat is absolutely essential. But then, you know, that's not even the whole story because it's not just what you eat. It's how you process it, too. You can eat the best stuff there is on the planet as far as nutrition is concerned. But if your digestive tract isn't healthy, how are you going to process it? If you don't digest, absorb, keep the toxins out, have the right carrier proteins to take it where it needs to go in the body, it's not going to do you any good. So it's not just what you eat. It's how healthy you are, how healthy your digestive tract is, and how you process what you eat.
You know, if you are a vegetarian for health reasons only, according to this study, you do lower your risk of heart disease. But we do think that grass-fed beef and wild non-farmed fish are good for your health. And one way, I think, to get this across is to ask for it when you go to restaurants.
Well, yeah.
Our pocketbooks talk. You know?
Well, that's right. Not a lot of people can't afford that. You know, we live in the city now. We don't live in the country. We don't grow our own food. We're not hunters and gatherers anymore. We depend on food products. And, of course, all these food products are exactly that, food products. If they've got a cellophane package around it and a list of ingredients, it doesn't look like celery or cucumbers or squash. It's a food product that's been modified in so many ways that it's no longer good for us.
Well, that's the other thing is a lot of the meat that's in the regular grocery stores, not the health food stores, but the grocery stores, many times they have food coloring.
Oh, yeah.
Because the meat wouldn't look red like that. The meat would look brown.
We know that.
And the same with the fish, the farm fish. They put food coloring in that to make it look
orange. Actually, a lot of those salmon that you buy that are farm raised come out gray.
Yeah.
And if you don't do something to them to change their color, it doesn't look like salmon anymore. Of course, it really isn't salmon anymore. All right. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on the truth about organic food. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, does vitamin C cause or prevent kidney stones? So stay tuned.
Since big business has realized that there's a marketplace for organic and natural food, there's been an abuse of the labeling and production of organic food. Now, certified organic prohibits the use of synthetic fertilizers, sewage, sludge, irradiation, genetic engineering, and often organic doesn't necessarily mean close to nature at all. The industrialization of organic farms has resulted in a greener system of factory farming. They're playing up the rustic images, and many have their own system of factory farming. Now, industrial farming often raises chickens in cages only to let them out to pasture for just a few minutes as long as they've had organic feed. And the certification, the certified organic label is expensive, and the organic factory farms that mass produce can afford it. And many small farms have superior quality, but they can't afford the certification. So, as we've always said, it's safer to just go to the source, like the small farms, and to go to these farmers markets and talk to the farmers. You know, some of them, like I just said, can't afford the organic certification, but their food is organic. And so some of that comes down to trust, too. But the health food stores, I've noticed now that they have a section for fresh eggs. that are, they're a little more expensive, but they do have them because a lot of these, I've noticed that a lot of the eggs will say organic, but then they don't say that they're pastured, mm-hmm. you know, or they don't say that they're cage free, but they'll say organic, and it's confusing. So you have to really look and read all those labels and so forth. There's a lot of confusion about organic and natural. So a good resource to learn more about it is called What to Eat by Marion Nessel, and it helps to sort through the food labels if you want to learn more about that.
Well, it really tells you you have to do your homework. You need to know the person from which you're getting your food. If you're going to a farmer's market, get to know those people. Find out what their integrity is like and see if they're if you can tell if it's really organic or what they're doing. So knowing where you're buying a product and who the people are is an important thing. And I think that's really important for restaurateurs who are getting food that they're serving to the masses. So this is a big topic. And
it's big money. I mean, you go to the regular grocery stores nowadays and there's organic in a lot of places because they know it sells and people want it. But they mass produce it and their standards aren't like the smaller farmers.
And there are a lot of little tricks too. If you're buying, say, an organic breakfast cereal of some kind, unless every item in it says organic in front of it, you can be sure it's not.
Okay, so nobody wants kidney stones. Ouch!
I'll say.
Ever heard that vitamin C can cause kidney stones? Is this truth or myth? Is it fact or an association or a coincidence? Well, this report shows that it increases the risk, but it's not proven. And I noticed here that there were a lot of conflicting studies. So what do you have to say about vitamin C and kidney stones?
Well, first of all, it doesn't cause kidney stones. Okay, there's a lot of data that's been done years ago that went over this topic many times and cleared it up. And now a study comes out in one of the JAMA journals called Internal Medicine in March of 2013. It isn't even out yet, but we've had a look at the study early. And they showed that men on 1 gram a day of vitamin C had double the risk of kidney stones. But the point is this was a study that was done by association. It wasn't a study that was done that was a randomized controlled study. There were only a few people who had stones. There were 31 people in the study that had stones, so there's lots of room for statistical error. The other thing is it wasn't a randomized controlled study, and vitamin C was not given to a group of people selected at random, and then half of them put on the vitamin C, the other half not.
Well, then there was another study that showed that there was calcium in the urine and in the blood, but there were no stones after a year anyway.
Well, it's something to pay attention to, but you've got to understand vitamin C before you start making comments like this. Just because there was an article that was published which showed actually something that was true, and what it showed is that if you took vitamin C and calcium in relatively large doses, that you would have higher levels of serum calcium. You'd also have higher levels in the urine. But the answer to this was, were there any kidney stones found in these studies? And the answer was no. You've got to know what vitamin D does before you say that, because actually vitamin D solubilizes calcium, okay, when it's in the urine, so it's not likely to combine with oxalate and form the calcium oxalate kidney stones, which is what we're talking about.
So tell us about some of the different kinds of common stones and how the vitamin C can actually offer protection.
Well, there are five different kinds of major stones that we know about. And so you're looking at the calcium phosphate stones, of which there are a lot. And vitamin C actually acidifies the urine. And when it does, it makes calcium phosphate more soluble. In fact, if you wanted to treat people who had calcium phosphate stones, you'd give them vitamin C and dissolve them.
Because it dissolves it, huh?
Yeah. When you're looking at calcium oxalate stones, that's a different story. And there you'd have to add other things to it, like the B vitamins and magnesium citrate, to try and dissolve those stones. And very often you can't. And then there are other kinds of stones, like uric acid stones that are unrelated to it, and cysteine stones, and those are not stones that you see very often. So when you're looking at the different types of stones, you'd have to say vitamin C might be a treatment. And because vitamin C solubilizes calcium and oxalate, which is probably the kinds of stones they were talking about, but you know, this study was so bad that it didn't even look at the kinds of stones that were there, you'd have to say it would lower the risk for that because of the solubilization of both the oxalate and the calcium.
Well, how would you even know what kind of stone you had?
You have to analyze them. So when the stone passes, you take it back to the doctor who sends it to the lab, and they analyze it to see what it's made of. The whole thing started out because vitamin C is metabolized into five waste products, of which one is oxalate. And so oxalate, being the thing that forms calcium oxalate stones, might be something you'd want to know about, because it would make sense that the higher the level of the oxalate, the higher the risk. And so studies have been done looking at how much vitamin C you give someone and what their oxalate levels are. And in general, they didn't go up much if they did. And if you're worried about that, and I might be, if I had a calcium oxalate stone, I might want to know what my oxalate level was. So I'd be inclined, if I wanted to take vitamin C, to look and see what my oxalate excretion was for 24 hours in the urine off of vitamin C, and then take it and see if it went up. That might convince me to do something a little differently, depending on what it was.
Now, one of these articles was talking about too much. And so they said too much vitamin D would be anything over, 4,800?
Well, they
units and calcium over 1,400.
Well, that was an assumption that was made on their part. They thought that would be too much, but we know that we need roughly 5,000 IUs a day of vitamin D. Now, this is different than C, so we want to make sure that you know that we're talking about a different topic here.
Well, they talked like vitamin C, if you took more than 1,000, that was really a lot.
Well, that's somebody's opinion again. That's not based on any fact, because we know that people have been given 10 or 15 grams IV a day don't get into trouble. But that doesn't really mean that vitamin C is safe for everybody. It's not.
Would it make a difference whether you took it by mouth or IV?
No, I think there'd probably be more of a problem if you took it by mouth, actually, because it's the gut and the bacteria in the colon that convert the vitamin C into oxalate. And that's where most of the oxalate comes from. Well, intravenously, it would be less of an issue.
I think it's interesting that calcium supplements can actually protect against kidney stones.
Well, that's true. With supplements and a high calcium diet protect against kidney stones. We did a whole video on that on drspooter.com. If you're interested in learning more about it, go there and put that in the search box and this will come up.
Okay, and what about parathyroidism? Because sometimes that can cause kidney stones.
Well, in people who have hyperparathyroidism, that's a big issue. You do see a high incidence of calcium oxalate stones. And so you might want to screen for that if you have a problem with it. I know in my own case, turns out I had a kidney stone a few years ago, and indeed I turned out to have hyperparathyroidism.
So what can you do for that?
You've got to take it out, and if it's causing problems. So mine's still sitting in there. When I work up my courage, I'm going to go have that little non-cancerous adenoma removed.
Okay, now diets that increase the risk, I think it's important to talk about that, like high fructose corn syrup and animal protein and sodium and sugars and colas and not drinking enough fluid.
Okay, all these work in slightly different ways. You're looking at your sugars of different kinds. They increase the risk of the levels of uric acid production, which can serve as the nidus from which a calcium stone can form around it. So you can have a uric acid stone that's there, and that can increase the incidence of calcium oxalate stones.
I think it's also helpful for people to know the symptoms of a kidney stone. We all know that you can have severe flank pain.
I can tell you about that.
I know.
As I got out of bed one morning and had this nausea and back pain that was breathtaking. I tried to get out of bed and I was on all fours and I went right back to bed.
Well, blood in the urine, also an urgency of having to urinate, and nausea and vomiting, sweating and being restless. So as we always say, live a healthy lifestyle and only supplement your diet with nutritional supplements if it's necessary.
Well, that's right. I think we want to stick with natural things. So when we're looking at this business of vitamin C and kidney stones, I think it's fairly straightforward. They do not cause kidney stones, but at the same time, we got to keep in mind that we don't want to just give everybody vitamin C. If there's a reason to do it, you do it. But if you give it to somebody who's in renal failure and on dialysis, you'll kill them with systemic oxalosis. If you have the G6PD defect, which causes a hemolytic anemia, that's a form of hemolytic anemia, it will cause a massive lysis of your blood cells. All right, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health radio, and we'll be talking about, when we come back, does everybody need a calcium supplement? So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health radio. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki.
As you know, we report on thousands of studies, and some are large and some are small. But what's important is who did the studies, if there's a conflict of interest, who funded them, and if the findings are associations or assumptions, as opposed to randomized placebo-controlled studies. It's also interesting to note that some studies on the same topic come out differently. And what's really weird to me is when a study says one thing and the summary ignores the finding and recommends doing what you've already been doing until further studies. I mean, why would you do that if there's any doubt? There are a lot of scandals. So let's talk about calcium increasing the risk of heart disease. Is this in men and women, or just men? Because there are different opinions in these studies that just came out. And why are the reports conflicting?
Well, it's one of the reasons why you have to look at a lot of studies. And as we look back over the last 20 or 25 years, there were studies done at Kaiser Hospital years ago on people who had osteoporosis. And what they found is that those people had osteoporosis had a higher risk for heart attack and stroke. So this is not new information. And there have been many replications of that. That's in people who have osteoporosis. It's because what happens is we try to drive calcium back into our bones. So we take more calcium in an effort to try and replace what we've lost. And the problem is that we have a metabolic tendency to lose calcium from bone in the first place for a lot of reasons. Maybe our vitamin D intake is low, or maybe our vitamin K is low. Maybe we don't have the micronutrients we need to try and build bone, like copper and zinc and boron and silica and all magnesium,
chromium.
Lots of things like that. So when we're looking at this issue, we have to pay attention to factors like that. And we know that we want to try and stick with Mother Nature the best that we can. And if we live a healthy lifestyle and we consume foods in like vegetables and fruit and seeds and nuts and whatever else is healthy for us, that the chances are we're going to get all the calcium that we need. We're probably not going to have a problem with osteoporosis and not have a tendency to consume supplements to try and offset that. So when a study comes out, which two studies came out, and it shows the difference between men and women, it sort of makes you wonder what could be different in those studies, because you don't know what to do. But fortunately, we have this history that tells us that we need calcium in a certain amount. If you overdo it, you're going to get into trouble. So if you wind up taking large doses, say more than 1,000 milligrams a day, which I'll rarely give to my patients.
Isn't that something that's pretty routine with gynecologists to give them to their women patients?
Well, they're trying to prevent osteoporosis.
Postmenopausal.
Indeed. So maybe the first thing to do is to do a DEXA bone scan to see whether or not you have a normal bone density or not. And if you have a tendency for osteoporosis, maybe then you'd give a little bit more calcium, but you should measure a vitamin D level as well and see if they're low.
And probably not give the calcium alone.
I wouldn't give the calcium alone, and I wouldn't give huge doses to anybody, because I think those women who need the calcium the most because their bones are losing it are the ones that are at the highest risk for developing arteriosclerosis, because we tend to give more of it.
Well, the JAMA study was on men, and it said that the risks of a heart attack from supplementing with calcium outweigh the benefit from the osteoporosis.
Yeah, well, but you don't need to take any risks at all if you use your head. I mean, you can do
you
a bone density.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
not going to go around and giving all my patients calcium supplements. I don't do that. But if I'm concerned at all about the possibility of osteoporosis, you do a bone density test. You see where they are, and then measure a vitamin D level. And then if you find that they have low bone density, you replace that. And that's the first thing to do. It's not about using drugs to try and build up bone, because we know there are lots of problems with that. If you want to learn more about those drugs, then we go to drsaputo.com put things like Fosamax or Boniva or Didronel in the search box and learn about the bisphosphonates and all their complications. So calcium's not any smarter a thing to do in general, But we should have a diet that's balanced, that has plenty of calcium in it. That's
natural. Well, besides the almonds and the leafy greens, there's dairy and beans also to get calcium.
Lots of ways to get calcium. That's a natural way to do it.
Well, also, you know, these studies differed on the effects in the men and the women, but they both talked about the concerns in taking calcium supplements and how they could increase the risk of death from heart disease. Mm-hmm. But then at the end of the article, it says to supplement with calcium is a safe and reasonable approach.
Well, see,
this is like what is so weird to me. This happens over and over again in these studies.
People are scared, Vicki. They're afraid to step up and be authentic and to stand behind the kinds of things that their studies show.
Well, I was always taught, if in doubt, don't.
Well, that's what they're doing in this. If they're in doubt, they're not sure about the
results. No, I mean, if the results are putting you in doubt,
I know,
don't take calcium supplements.
Yeah, but if you don't know for sure that your data is that solid, and you see a lot of other data out there and you have doubt about it, I would say you better do a better study and figure out what's going on. And like I said, you don't want to just take and put everybody into one category and say that we need to all have a certain amount of calcium, because that's just silly. Certainly the people that need calcium metabolism changed are those people that have osteoporosis, but you've got to look at why they have osteoporosis and try to fix that. And most of the time it's a vitamin D deficiency.
And it's not about just popping Tums and chewing plain calcium, because when you think about it, our bones are not just made out of chalk, and that's why you were saying that you needed to take a supplement with other things.
Magnesium and copper and boron and zinc and silica,
phosphorus
and vitamin D and vitamin K. I mean, all these things make healthy bone.
And so, too, just to go over a little bit what you had said, that the extra calcium that's not needed in our bones, it tends to go to our soft tissues, and that includes our arteries.
Yeah, especially if you have a tendency to lose calcium from your bones because you don't have enough vitamin D and vitamin K. So, I mean, it's about knowing your patients. To just say everybody needs to take calcium of a certain amount is nonsense. I mean, we all have different intakes. We all have different health issues. And if we pay attention to that, chances are we're going to get it right. This article also said that people that take in too little calcium are in trouble as well. Because what happens if you take in
Under 600 milligrams total, that includes what you
diet
eat.
Diet or supplements or whatever leads to that too. So it's like baby bear's porridge. You know, it's got to be just right.
Well, just about a handful of almonds, I think, is probably a
Well, it has, that gives you some, but you're under 100 milligrams there of calcium. You're more like
about, and if you had six handfuls.
Yeah, then you got a lot of calories. Yeah. You know, a cup of almonds has 900 calories in it. So, you have to really try to be balanced about what you do and keep in mind that everybody's different. And when you get to know somebody as a physician, you want to pay attention to who they are. What do they look like? Are they thin and frail? Are they big and strong and robust?
Are they hunched over?
Do they exercise? Are they on drugs that might cause a problem with calcium loss and osteoporosis? Who are they? And when you know that, then you can start being specific about how much calcium I want to give? How much vitamin D do I want to give? Do these people need vitamin K? Should I be adding something like strontium? Is a bisphosphonate the right way to go, which almost never is, but it's still something that's a consideration because it makes old bone, which you really don't want. But it's better than no bone, but the complications and side effects of the drug really turn me off.
So many times people just accept, you know, what their doctors tell them, and that's why it's good to listen to shows like this, because we talk about the different points of view and the different studies and help you to make your own decisions and to think for yourself.
Well, your doctor very often is learning from the pharmaceutical rep. He's not the person, or she's not the person you want to be paying much attention to. You've got to do your own research. You have to know who your patient is, and you put those things together, you've got some kind of chance of getting it right.
And then when you get through reading this whole study, at the bottom line says, this study does not change the recommendations, nor should it, you know, where they recommend how much calcium to take. The Institute of Medicine recommends 2,000 milligrams.
These people need to do a little psychotherapy to develop something called authenticity. Okay, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on a diet for stress. And when we come back, we'll be talking about what's the difference between systolic and diastolic hypertension And is melatonin effective as a cancer treatment? Stay tuned.
I have a diet that's designed to help you cope with the stress that builds up during the day. For breakfast, a grapefruit, a slice of whole wheat toast that's dry, and 3 ounces of skim milk.
That doesn't sound that good. Going to lose weight on that part.
Well, then at lunch, you can have 4 ounces of lean broiled chicken breast, 1 cup of spinach, 1 cup of herb tea, and 1 Oreo cookie.
Oh, well, that's sounding better.
And then for a snack in the afternoon, you can have the rest of the Oreos in the package, 2 pints of Rocky Road ice cream, 1 jar of hot fudge sauce, and nuts, cherries, and whipped cream.
Well, you lose weight part of the day.
For dinner, 2 loaves of garlic bread with cheese, large sausage, mushroom and cheese pizza, 4 cans or 1 large pitcher of beer, and 3 Milky Way or Snickers candy bars. And the late evening, an entire frozen cheesecake eaten directly from the freezer.
Oh, my gosh.
So I have some rules for this diet. If you eat something and no one sees you eat it, it has no calories.
I love it.
If you drink a diet soda with a candy bar, the calories in the candy bar are canceled out by the diet soda. When you eat with someone else, calories don't count if you don't eat more than they do. And food used for medicinal purposes never counts, such as hot chocolate, brandy, toast, Sara Lee cheesecake. If you fatten up everyone else around you, then you look thinner. Movie-related foods do not have additional calories because they're part of the entire entertainment package and not part of one's personal fuel, such as Milk Duds, buttered popcorn, Junior Mints, Red Hots, Tootsie Rolls, cookies. Cookie pieces contain no calories. The process of breaking causes calorie leakage. And things licked off knives and spoons have no calories if you're in the process of preparing something. Examples, peanut butter on a knife when making a sandwich or ice cream on a spoon when you're making a sundae. And last but not least, foods that have the same color have the same number of calories. For example, spinach and pistachio ice cream.
I see.
Mushrooms and white chocolate.
Right.
And you need to note that chocolate is a universal color and it may be substituted for any other food color. Just like with Monopoly.
This is a great diet. It reminds me of when we went to the Mauna Kea on our honeymoon.
Oh, my gosh.
I think we gained 1 pound a day because the food came with it. It was so good. We'd have this huge breakfast. We're sick at lunch and didn't eat anything. And then we started again about 4 p.m. And by the next morning, we're still stuffed.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the trouble with this diet that I was just talking about, because for breakfast, you don't eat enough. So it's better to have breakfast.
I think you're right.
And not starve yourself so that you're just picking out on everything.
You got it.
So if you have hypertension, this information should interest you, particularly if your systolic pressure is high. That's the top number. Here's a study claiming to have new information and a new test that isn't really new, but it's often ignored by mainstream medicine. So let's talk about the definitions of hypertension and why treatment guides are not appropriate for everyone. And then we'll talk about what's the difference between diastolic and systolic hypertension.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways to look at hypertension, and we tend to have a single cutoff point at 140 over 90 and saying anything above either of those numbers is abnormal. And it's actually a continuum, and we do the best probably with a blood pressure of something like 110 over 70. And
then you have a little leeway, too.
Well, you do. But there's kind of a linear relationship between heart attacks and strokes between 110 over 70 and 140 over 90. So anywhere in there above 110 over 70, you're going to have a slightly increased risk. But, you know, most people, at least on the average, have a blood pressure of about 120 over 80. So we have to take that into account. Now, systolic hypertension means that the top number is high. So you may have a blood pressure of 140 over 80. And that would be much different than 120 over 80 because the difference between the two numbers is greater. That number is called the pulse pressure. So the difference between the top number and the bottom number is actually the most predictive number for heart attacks and strokes and vascular insufficiency and other kinds of problems related to hypertension.
Well, what if somebody had low blood pressure and there was a big difference and they had a pulse pressure?
It doesn't work that way. That's a very good question. The lower the blood pressure gets, the less important it becomes. When you're below about 130 over 80, you don't need to worry about it anymore. But when you go higher than that, so you, say you're your bottom number, your diastolic, is 80 and your top number is 180, I mean, there would be a difference of 100. That would be a very big difference, and that would be much more significant in terms of causing problems. So the pulse pressure is the most important number. The next most important number is the top number, the systolic, and lastly, the diastolic.
So what's the difference between the diastolic and the systolic?
The pulse pressure. So if it was 120 over 80, it would be 40. If it was 180 over 80, it would be 100. So that's what it is. Now,
what causes them is what does the top number mean and what does the bottom number mean? That's what I mean.
Okay, usually in isolated systolic hypertension, what's wrong is that there's stiffness of the arteries in general. So that when the heart pumps, it doesn't get that elastic give to it that recoils back and forms a nice pulse wave that you'd like to see. And that's a kind of hypertension that leads to organ failure, the heart attacks and strokes. That's the worst kind. The other kind of hypertension is more vascular constriction, so that if your heart is pumping against arteries that are in spasm, they're smaller, it takes a greater pressure to force it through a smaller hole. So that tends to be a different scenario, and most of the drugs that we use are aimed at what? At reducing the pulse pressure of someone who has what I would call humeral hypertension, or the kind that's caused by stress that leads to this difference in pressure.
I was always told that systolic was like when your heart was contracting and the diastolic was when it was relaxing.
That's correct. That's exactly right. And the more is stiff, the more difficult it is for the heart to pump blood around. And so what happens is that the time of pumping increases and the time of relaxation decreases. And so you wind up with the heart not filling so well, and you wind up with a problem that leads to an enlarged heart and an increased risk for heart attack and stroke.
And you can visualize that would be more pressure.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do you measure this arterial stiffness?
You just take a pulse wave that's in a finger. So you put a little pressure gauge on the tip of your finger around the nail and the bed of the finger. And you can see what the shape of that wave looks like. And based on that, you can tell how much give there is. And you can see how wide the pulse is, how wide the waveform is.
Well, that just sounds too easy.
Well, it is, and we should be doing that all the time because it's a great test for screening, and it's really cheap. But it's not nearly
as... So why do you think it's been pretty much ignored until now?
Well, it doesn't make much money. And the people who are into hypertension, into cardiology, would rather do the expensive cardiac echo test, which is probably about $800 in a lot of places.
Don't they do other things like arteriograms and CT
or
scans?
You may get to doing things like that if you're worried about heart failure or about a problem with circulation. But when you're just looking at hypertension and trying to assess it, you really want to look at the systolic, the diastolic, the pulse pressure, and the vascular stiffness if you want a good idea of what's happening.
Well, so now on this, according to this article, their way to measure it is with a walking blood pressure, ambulatory blood pressure
monitor,
and
they have included in it a vascular stiffness monitor. It's a nice combination and a tool that really most practitioners should have, because it enables you to take about 80 blood pressures through the day and get an idea of what the ranges of the blood pressure are. Because when you go to the doctor's office and have your blood pressure taken, that's the most unreliable place that you can take your blood pressure. Because usually you're in a cold room, you're worried about what the number is going to be, or you're worried about something else, you're in a stressful situation, it gives you an adrenaline response, and up goes your blood pressure because that's a physiological thing to do that's normal. So we over-treat way too many people. Taking them at home is a much better way to do it, and have people just take it twice a day for 2 or 3 weeks, and you get an idea what it's like. But the best way to do it is to monitor somebody for 24 hours and get about 80 blood pressures and see what the patterns are. You learn a lot from that.
Okay, so now they've added to be able to measure your vascular stiffness or arterial stiffness.
Exactly, exactly.
So why are conventional hypertensive drugs ineffective for systolic hypertension?
Well, what they really do are they're trying to treat the vascular the vascular constriction. So if you have vasoconstriction of the arteries get small, mm-hmm. and the heart has to pump harder to make pressure, they relax that artery so that it gets bigger. But if you have a problem with vascular stiffness, it's not really addressing that.
It's not going to help that to relax it? Can you relax it even?
It might, but it may lower cardiac output too. So you've got a problem there.
What's that mean?
How much blood the heart can pump around. So you might have insufficient blood for the tissues to oxygenate it. So these blood pressure findings, these different types of blood pressure are treated differently. I think for vascular stiffness, it causes hypertension, and this isolated systolic hypertension. You need to look at things like, how are you going to get rid of the cholesterol plaque that's in there? How are you going to lower the hypertension, the high values that you get?
Isn't this where a lot of people turn to statins?
Yeah, they might use statins for some of that, particularly if cholesterol is an issue. But, you know, most people have some kind of a problem with cholesterol or something related to it. So a lot of people.
Well, what makes the artery stiff?
Well, they age. Normally, when you age, that will do it. Certainly, stress over the long haul can do some of that. It's mostly lifestyle stuff. So everybody's hypertension is a little bit different, and so we have to look at each person individually, and on the basis of that, decide what the best treatment is.
Melatonin, the sleep hormone, that has other functions than jet lag insomnia. We have another fast track on how it can be helpful for Alzheimer's, along with exercise, and useful for beta blocker insomnia. It's also no secret that it can be helpful for treating cancer, although it is often overlooked. So we'd like to give this immune booster more recognition for its role in fighting cancer. How does melatonin work as a cancer treatment?
Well, it's pretty interesting because it stimulates those natural killer cells, those immune cells that fight cancer and fight viral infections, so that there are more of them and they're more active. It actually works as an anti-angiogenic factor, which means it blocks the production of new blood vessels, which cancers have to have in order to be able to grow. So that's a very powerful way to go. It increases the tendency for cancer cells to die, a process called apoptosis, because cancer cells are immortal and continue to grow. And the problem is they never die. It also decreases tumor growth. And it probably increases survival from the studies that have been published of people who are having side effects by about 45%. And those are side effects from chemotherapy and radiation.
So it's compatible with conventional treatment.
Oh, yeah. It has other functions as well. It can protect and help low platelet counts. It can increase white blood cell counts. The fatigue and weakness and neurotoxicity and nausea and vomiting and loss of appetite, all those things are helped by it.
And the mouth sores, huh?
Yeah.
And the heart?
Well, these are things that, you know, have been studied by a fellow named Lissoni in Italy. And this man is so depressed because he knows how well this works, and nobody's studying it. He can't get funding to study it.
Because he can't make money off of it,
can't make any money off of it. When the Cancer Treatment Centers of America did a study on this, what they found was that it increased the one-year survival in many cancers with doses between 10 and 40 milligrams a day. And about 25 to 60% of the patients, they live quite a bit longer.
Is 10 to 40 milligrams a lot? I mean, how much?
Well, we make microgram doses, so yeah, it's huge. The amount that's taken in a typical sleeping pill is more like about 2 milligrams or 3 milligrams, and some of them even a half a milligram, but that's thousands of times more than what the body makes. So you don't want to just go around taking melatonin. I do not recommend it as a regular thing.
So how do people find somebody that knows how to treat with melatonin?
Well, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America would be good, but most any complementary and alternative doctor who treats for cancer would know how to do that. So this is a really good thing to add to most regimens. I can't think of too many situations where I wouldn't offer that to a patient if they wanted a complementary and alternative approach. And this would be just one of many kinds of things that we could do, because there are lots of treatments that are complementary and alternative that fit with mainstream therapies. This is particularly effective in stage 4 cancers, where the 5-year survival rates using chemotherapy and conventional therapies is 2%.
Well, this really shows remarkable benefits, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Okay, Vicki, we're at the end of the show, and we'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health every Monday morning on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on drsabuda.com as well as prn.fm.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. Remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a good week. We'll see you next time.